Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. It's a good job TNA is back just as people are forgetting what a swerve is. I've been told that the reason Matt Stryker got the job was because Rob Bartlett didn't return his messages, and I think that Toriano's tights may have been stolen off an Indian restaurant wall.
I'm G. John Chase, and to prepare for this New Japan podcast, I decided to watch Lost in Translation, a fantastic film that I watched for 5 hours. 2 hours to watch the actual film, and 3 hours to watch that opening scene of Scarlett Johansson's ass. You know what I'm talking about. Come on, you've done it too.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke. And I spent the first half of Wrestle Kingdom pontificating over what a monster heel Adam Bomb would have been in New Japan. I can honestly say I've never been so depressed that Brian Clark's dead.
And I'm Carl Jones, and last time I did an intro for this show, I ragged on just how piss poor I thought Christmas was. The turkey was as dry as a Randy Orton promo, the Brussels sprouts stank as bad as Brian Knobb's armpit, and as for the weather on the day, it wasn't so much snow, more a deluge of wet and sogginess that was more akin to a ring boy's feet in the 1980s.
This is the panel for the 26th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us break down New Japan Pro Wrestling's Wrestle Kingdom 9 next. Hello everyone, and welcome to the 26th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Hi, Blake Lowe.
Carl Jones.
I sleep in a drawer.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening all.
And it is good to have you back with us after our 2 week break. Last episode we were talking to Jeff Jarrett and discussing about Global Force Wrestling. To prepare for this, Wrestle Kingdom 9 on January 4th has come and gone, and we are here today to talk about that very event. Very interesting to watch that show with this panel. We have a very mixed amount of experience watching New Japan. Myself, I've been watching it for a long time, and G. John Chase, you too.
Oh, yeah.
Kieran O'Rourke. Yeah, you're a bit more of a casual New Japan viewer, I'd say, correct?
Yeah, my watching of Japanese wrestling in general is quite spurious. I'm not sure it's the right word.
Sporadic,
we'll go with sporadic. I've watched a lot of stuff over the various decades and years, different eras in Japanese wrestling. But in terms of current New Japan, familiar with pretty much all the guys.
Yeah, you've watched pay-per-views, but
yeah, I've seen a lot. Familiar with the backgrounds of most of the main stories anyway, and obviously main guys, but not contemporary as in watching much in the last year or two. Again, it's sporadic viewing at their best, really.
Okay, and Carl, the more virgin viewer, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, I'm not really sure I appreciate the word virgin being used. Thanks for that one. Especially over a wrestling podcast, you know, the sort of connotations that probably my experience of New Japan, I'd watched older stuff. I haven't watched anything recent for probably, you know, 3 or 4 years, I think it's fair to say. Prior to that, it would be more a case of matches, sort of isolated matches that people had recommended to me.
Yeah, cherry picking bits of that history that you've been notified about elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fair to say. So we've got a bit of a mixed reaction. We also had some other people watching with us. But just to kind of run down the card here, now that we've got a bit of an idea of our perspectives going in, the first match on the show, actually we didn't see because it wasn't on the pay-per-view feed that we got, but it was the New Japan Rumble. Featuring Yuji Nagata winning, which we'll play into things as things go forward, as we'll get to later on in the podcast. But this, G-John Chase, you feel a little bit aggrieved that Yuji Nagata did not, in fact, get to go onto this show?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're talking about a former IWGP champion who actually held the record for most title defenses until Tanahashi beat it in, I think it was 2012. So, yeah, I mean, and also just to add on the fact that he's also the Noah heavyweight champion last year as well. So it's just like a pretty big name being relegated to the pre-show match, even though if he did win it. But it was just like this apparently quite a piss-poor rumble anyway.
Yeah, 24, 25 minutes of apparently not great action.
I think looking at some of the other matches on the card, particularly some of the earlier ones, I think there was definitely a place that, you know, for Nagata. I think it's a bit of a shame that he was kind of treated that way.
Okay, we can move on to that shortly when we talk about these early matches. You maybe finger out one that you decide is going to be the one that you should move off the card. Moving straight in here to the main card here. Obviously, Jim Ross and Stryker on the call. We got your feedback to get to as well for your picks for match of the night and your thoughts on the show overall and Matt Stryker and Jim Ross. But moving on to the first match, it was Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish of Red Dragon beating the Forever Hooligans, the Time Splitters and the Young Bucks in 13 minutes. The way to kick off the show here. Very fast-paced match. Keen to throw this one out to the forum. Thoughts on the opener here?
Pretty much kind of what I was expecting from these four teams. I mean, this type of match is quite well established now, particularly with the junior heavyweight tag.
Yeah, this is what they've been
division.
Doing for quite well.
Yeah, I mean, at very least for the last year, every show starts with a junior tag team title match. Typical kind of indie-rific, like, spots galore. Not quite sure how it's going to translate to a Japanese audience, because it's usually kind of a bit of usually something like Lost in Translation there with those kind of matches sometimes. Probably that's why they put on first. Entertaining and all, but kind of more style and no substance.
I think G raises a good point there about this sort of Lost in Translation with the crowd. I mean, pardon the pun. But part of the difficulty is that the crowd at no point in that match had chance to breathe. There was no chance to absorb anything. And I understand the logic of, you know, a sort of a fast-paced opener. We see the logic sort of more in sort of the Western world, if you like, the fast-paced opener to get the crowd sort of worked up a little bit early doors. But to me, it didn't come across particularly well. There's several individuals involved that I'm not fans of.
We will get to them. We can break that down a little bit shortly.
Yeah. Rocky Romero being one, the Young Bucks being others. I won't tell you what I call them. I'll let Kieran throw that one in. But one sort of single point that really stuck out, and it's something that I hate in matches like this, is the convoluted dive over onto the other team, followed by another person diving over onto the other team, followed by another person. I understand it. It's pro wrestling. We know what it is. But that, for me, even that spot is too contrived.
They're not kind of used to it. It's a lot better when
they're
it's more...
They're used to it. It just doesn't get over.
Yeah, it's a lot better when it's more subtle, though, because there's going to be like wrestlers later on in the show where they don't do as many dives, but they mean more when they do them.
Imagine that.
And so, hence...
Pro Wrestling 101.
I was shocked to hear Dave Meltzer suggest this as possibly a 4-star match and said that he thought this was tons of fun. And it was a very fun match. You can sit there and watch this car crash spectacle. But as a Kieran, you've been quiet so far. I'm keen to get you to dive in here to see what your thoughts on this one were.
I'm just letting people talk. Just the aforementioned Carl quotes from this. My little notepad here. Which, you know,
yeah, Kieran was jotting down notes throughout the show. A true pro.
Well, I started to, and then it's not really my style. I like to just immerse myself in the emotion of things, not analyse things on the first viewing. That's just how I roll. but first off the bat, from Carl quotes of the evening, was for the Young Bucks, and I quote, "Petal dick fuckers," which is quickly followed by, "I thought Alex Shelley was dead."
That's real class stuff,
yeah.
Carl.
Yeah, in terms of the match, I mean, yeah, what's been said really. I got down here. It was, you know, the guys worked hard. I mean, that's from top to bottom.
Oh yeah, the effort was there for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. But yeah, very indie-rific is actually the word I tried to scribble down here, but I wasn't sure how you spell indie-rific, so kind of indie, and then it kind of just tailed off into. I mean, cold crowd. This is I really listened to JR throughout the show, and we'll get onto this as we go. I've got some feelings on his performance. This one off the bat, you talk about the crowd is lost. JR was lost,
yeah.
Because and this wasn't his fault. I mean, he said, first of all, the rules confusing. Why are they just brawling along?
Why are they not tagging in and out? Yeah, they have a count of five.
One point, JR. I think he actually said too many moves to keep
the core. Yeah.
JR, when he hasn't got. The term storytelling in wrestling is a cliche, and it's used by people who don't know what they're talking about and don't know what it even means a lot of the time. It means a couple of things for me. One, obviously, a story behind characters, backstory to the match, and the actual athletic story that's been told in the contest itself. JR, when he hasn't got a strong narrative to tell, is 70% JR. Kind of a recurring theme, less so as we got into it. When we'll get into
I thought it was more pronounced in the first three matches, particularly.
Yeah.
In these multi man tags, when all hell's breaking loose, and there isn't a whole hell of a lot of context emerge.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's just, and JR has never been a movers man. I think people forget the stick JR used to get when in like publication like Powerslam, so be it. But getting moves wrong or in the heat of moment, getting guys' names confused back and forth. And that was a big... back end of the last century. But that kind of got forgotten when people realised how good JR actually is. Yeah. But you take away his strength in storytelling for one of those, all those three elements. And JR's... He's 70% the guy. And that was... first match that hit me. As I say, it changed as it went on. But I think the elements of it I'll get into... Not something you get your teeth into. It's just it's a move fest. It's a computer game
You sit there and you just mindlessly observe all the athleticism. It is the way that it's very fun setup, and there were some very spectacular spots. That the doomsday device where both guys land on their feet was pretty damn cool. There were plenty of things that you could look at and be like, that's some pretty hot shit.
When you're seeing more subtle elements of the same big move fest in more significant matches later on with a bit more psychology, but there is a marginal returns element to it, I think, in the context of a 4-hour show in general, but we'll get onto that.
I think one move that kind of like kind of flummoxed a lot of people when we were watching it was they do the usual I can't think what the name of the move is, but like one's got him in the tombstone,
the Meltzer driver.
Right, so they usually do it, so you know, one sets him up in the tombstone, the other one does a springboard off the ropes and helps like jackhammer him down. But for some reason, this is the first time I've seen him do this, but for no reason the guy who was doing the springboard decided to do a flip first.
That's the Meltzer driver.
Yeah, and it was just like, we were just confused. We were just all like, well, that's just doing it for the sake of freaking doing it.
Right. It's not so much that I was confused. See the earlier word I used, which was contrived.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, take the Canadian Destroyer as another example. The PT Williams.
A fine line with these kind of moves.
It's impressive looking, but it just defies all logic. Defies complete logic. And when you've got a move such as the Meltzer driver, you're thinking, It's a spike tombstone is what it is.
Yeah.
But somewhere in their infinite wisdom, they've decided that if we throw a flip in here,
it needs more.
It's going to look really, it's going to look fantastic. Whereas actually, what it does is it makes the move look less impactful, because you've got the bloke doing a flip and then frantically trying to get any part of his hand on contact with the person who's being pile driven. And it just looks contrived, because they can barely get there. So it just looks like a standard pile driver that's been ballsed up anyway.
I think they did balls it up enough to the point where I think the whoever it was that was doing the springboard, I think he just slapped the guy's ass.
Yeah, that's what I did. It was basically a slap on the ass into a pile driver.
So you do not give it 5 stars?
I most certainly do not.
And for the people wondering out there, it was actually called the Meltzer driver because that flip is the flip that Meltzer did down his stairs when he broke his foot last year.
So. I want to ask, you kind of alluded there, Carl, to guys in the match that you didn't like, and the Young Bucks among them. I will say that the crotch chopping, for the Bullet Club in general, I'm not a fan of that.
This is my first Bullet Club experience, and I've got to say, I was very disappointed.
I'm convinced, and I'll say right now, before I throw this back to you, anybody on Facebook or anybody that wasn't into this, I love the Bullet Club. They don't watch New Japan that much. I'm convinced of it.
I haven't seen the gimmick in the context of what they do. It's just a bunch of guys. It was second rate, I thought. It was Bush League. I mean, the mannerisms, you do the NWO 2 Sweet in the DX crotch chop, and it's what are you?
Talented individuals within the Bullet Club, for sure, but the general theme of that being the gimmick of the Bullet Club, it just doesn't really do it for me.
I think Bush League was a very apt word to use in the end. It does just come across as second rate. And the Young Bucks, when they were even doing the crotch chops during the match, they didn't look natural doing it, did they? It was all, you almost got the impression there was something in the back of their mind saying every time, this doesn't come across very well.
It kind of comes across like it's not necessarily like, you know, they all sit around in the locker room and think like, oh, how are we going to look cool? It almost seems like it's something like that New Japan have asked of them, to thinking like, well, you're a heel group. You know, a foreign heel group, and we're expecting you to kind of, like, this is what you do, isn't it?
Not a big fan personally of Kyle O'Reilly. I want to get thoughts across the table. I think that he's, again, very, very talented, but there's just something about him that I don't know. It's that kind of inauthentic MMA. I don't like it in Ring of Honor. I don't like it here. I think he's very good, but at the same time, it's just one thing that's just, like, not for me.
Yeah, he's almost... I don't know. This is probably a terrible, terrible analogy, but he's almost like a sense of Loki without the kind of the Loki mystique. Not, that's a terrible analogy, but he's just a guy, and he's doing, it just doesn't wash with me.
Red Dragon, both of them, I go with Fish as well. They literally look like the kind of guys I would expect to come out of Ring of Honor. There's two guys in boots and kick pads that look similar to each other, that do some nice impressive moves. Say what you will about the Bucks or Rocky Romero and or Shelley or whatever, at least they try and do something. At least their look is different, you know. At least, you know, however cheesy it looks, you know, the Young Bucks have like a kind of look to them or whatever. They do kind of something a little bit different to make them stand out. With Red Dragon,
yeah,
they're
about
just
60 super kicks a match.
Super kicks.
But it's just like with Red Dragon, it's just two guys in trunks and kick pads. It's just like they look like everybody else that's on the indie circuit, which is not going to make them stand out.
We'll move swiftly along. The match was 30 minutes, obviously a lot to talk about there. We're going to move on to one that I don't think there's as much to talk about. The second match, Hiroyoshi Tenzan, Satoshi Kojima, and Tamaki Honma beat the Bullet Club of Yujiro Takahashi, Bad Luck Fale, and my good friend Jeff Jarrett in 5 minutes and 35 seconds. Thoughts across the table on something. Again, this was rushed and I wasn't sad about that.
Yeah, it was good that it was quick. I think the main good thing I'll take away from this is Honma got the win.
Oh, for sure.
That's the main thing, which I was kind of like surprised, but not surprised. Kind of get what I mean on that one, just because surprised by the fact that, you know, considering who his tag team partners are, we have Kojima and Tenzan, former IWGP champions, and Honma hasn't had that many wins, particularly in the last couple of years. But guessing
they reference that on commentary often enough.
Yeah. So I actually think probably the only reason I'd expect them to have actually given him that win was because of going off the back of G1, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
like
but
his popularity increasing.
Yeah, but at the same time, I thought the same thing several points during the G1 tournament. They never gave him the win, so it's like, are they ever gonna do this? I'm glad that they did do it at the Dome. Again, not too much to say about this one. Tenzan didn't really do much of anything. Kojima didn't get much of a chance to do anything. No. Jeff Jarrett swung a guitar, which is, you know, trademark. Not a whole lot to expand upon on that, really, other than Honma gets the win. Finally hit his big hope off the top, which he's been trying to get in for years.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Like you say, it was only just north of 5 minutes. It's a nice quick throwaway, a feel good for the crowd with the top rope headbutt getting them to the pay window, and Jarrett swings the guitar as you'd expect. So there was a couple of spots in there that people would have probably wanted to see. It was quick, so that meant it was relatively painless, and it was a feel good one for the fans with the faces going over.
Yeah, and just the main beneficial thing about that match being so quick is that it meant we got fuck all of fat fuck Fale.
Short, and I wasn't disappointed. It was short. I was quite, again, pleasantly surprised it was so short. For my notes, I've got geisha girl ass and then a tick. I like that. And then
the other casual fan speaks.
Other notes: people seem to care a bit about the Eric Young looking guy.
Honma.
Yeah.
Tamaki Honma, if you saw him on this show, he didn't really get a chance to shine himself, even though he did win the match. Go and watch his match with Katsuyori Shibata from the G1 Climax last year now. Very, very good match. You'll love him after that match. But moving on to match number 3, Naomi Chimarafuji, Mikey Nichols, Shane Haste, and Toru Yano defeated Suzuki Gun of David Boy Smith Jr., Lance Archer, Shelton X, Benjamin, and Takashi Iizuka in 5 minutes. Another very short match in which, once again, really not a whole hell of a lot to report on here, other than the fact that Marafuji looked pretty good when he was in there, even though it was brief.
Yeah, that was my main thing from social interrupt, because it's the only thing I've really got to say about this, was the time they give it, and I don't know if all the guys even got in the ring. I just thought Marufuji shouldn't be messing with these jobbers, to be honest. He's far too good for them. So
yeah, I mean, this was probably the least intriguing match a lot, I'd imagine, and this is one I was talking about where saying that there were spots for Nagata to be put in. You go looking at a main show like this, you should really be putting someone like Nagata in that spot instead, plus he's got history of all of the Suzuki Gun and so on. I thought the Marufuji one was a bit weird. It just seemed very tacked on. I mean, considering he's the Noah champion, it just seemed like very much like, oh shit, we can get him on the show. He's Yano's partner, and it's just like a real shame for someone of Marufuji's class, I would say, that he's in the third match on all, and he put in a good performance for the little time that he was in it. But it's just, again, the same as Nagata. It's just like, why are you doing this to someone with talent?
I can't think of much I've got to add to that. It was so. Such a short time span that the match, there's not really much you can comment on. There was just,
TMDK looked alright when they were in there.
Yeah, they looked okay. Like you say, it was a sort of minute spotlight, if you like, for Marufuji, though, as has already been echoed around the table, it surprisingly wasn't showcased in a more prominent role. But yeah, it was far too quick to really give it sort of any overly positive remarks or overly negative remarks.
Moving along now to the fourth match on the show, Minoru Suzuki defeated Kazushi Sakuraba in the UWF rules match. 9 minutes 20 seconds. This is where I thought Jim Ross really started to get into a little bit of a groove. We haven't really mentioned JR or Striker much beyond the opener. They were kind of serviceable. I thought Striker, we can get into him as the show goes on, and I'm sure we absolutely will. Yeah. But as a voice to kind of explain who's who and what's where, I thought he did a very good job. There were other parts of his work that I didn't think were so shining. We'll get to that. Jim Ross was far better in the one-on-one environment than he was in the tags, and it started here with Jim Ross talking about how he felt that Suzuki is the best student of Carl Gotch, Sakuraba is the best student of Billy Robinson. They're colliding. It's a long grudge rivalry for all these years. I'm curious to see how the match went over in this room, though.
I enjoyed the match primarily because it was like a proper story being told in a match. And yeah. It's something you get your teeth into, and I agree. I think when we said on the night, JR, it was something JR could get his teeth into as well. Now, honestly, I really wasn't a fan of JR on the show. Striker is Striker, and I thought JR kind of, at times, it struck me as rhetoric and cliches.
Who's Striker?
JR.
Oh, okay.
When he wasn't sure how the story that was being told and what he was supposed to tell, I thought he tended to drift into cliches a little bit, to be honest. But I enjoyed the match. The story, I like the story of Sakuraba hitting him on the outside. I didn't take offence to Sakuraba's rash guard like other people did. I enjoyed the match, but overall I did enjoy the match.
To Liam's earlier point, I think you can see where this would play more to JR's strengths on commentary, because it's got that sort of, even with it being a worked shoot, if you like, it's got that sort of that pure competition element, which is the sort of thing that JR thrives on. That being said, it was probably the only instance where they used MMA records where I didn't mind it. They kept going back to this sort of MMA record theme throughout the show, when it was completely irrelevant, completely unnecessary. And all the while I'm sat there thinking, I know this isn't MMA. If I want an MMA record or things like that, I'm going to watch MMA. and that's where it leads me with this match. I was not a fan.
No?
I was not a fan in the slightest. It bored me to tears.
Ooh, that's strong.
It really did. But it's just that with this match, it was just, in its attempt to try and be legitimate, it just almost delegitimized itself, if you like. I mean, you know, Suzuki had a cool look, as you say, but within a minute or two, my interest was waning dramatically.
I like the amateur wrestling stuff they did at the start, and I'll just throw to Ben Port here in the email, who mentioned that Sakuraba and Suzuki was his personal favourite match of the show, just to contrast with you, Carl. Thought I probably wouldn't say it was the best, but Misu's selling of the injured arm was the best selling on the show. Funny how that got more reaction than all the non-stop shit in the opener, huh? Suzuki's my favourite guy in the company, and getting to see him and Sakuraba slap and kick the shit out of each other was great fun. So I'll throw it to you now, G.
I think I might kind of slightly jump on Carl's bandwagon there with in terms of the match, because
I must immediately rethink what I've just said.
Yeah, because I said, like, I'm a fan of Suzuki. I like the guy. I think he's been kind of wading through the sludge for like a year
and a half at least.
More than that, we're probably looking at because the last time I think he was of any significance was Wrestle Kingdom 2012, when he challenged Tanahashi for a title.
He's had some matches with Okada since.
Yeah, it's been 2 years, and he definitely needs deserves a higher place up there, at least as a challenger, even if it's for a short period of time. It needs to be better than what they've been doing for the last 2 years. He's great, but I think my problem with the match is Sakuraba, because I think, like, I just don't buy him anymore.
Well, this is the thing. In certain circumstances, it does work. He had a match at Wrestle Kingdom 2 years ago with Nakamura in this style that was fucking great. It was the best match on the show. Now it's Nakamura, and Suzuki is fantastic in his own right, but it was a different style of match. It was a lot more selling, a lot less kind of grappling. They did grapple at the start, and I love that kind of stuff that they did in the first minute or so, but the more it degenerated into that kind of, like you said, that pseudo pro wrestling MMA hybrid, it didn't really work as well, because it didn't have the kind of legitimacy and the impact of the MMA. I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I can certainly see your perspective.
I will say that I did think Suzuki's selling was phenomenal. I will say that much. It strikes me as a match that where they didn't really know what they wanted it to be, and as a result, it ended up being a big nothing.
A couple of things. So I'm a big Suzuki fan, as you know. I think
one of your favourite guys in the company, right?
Yeah, I think he's got an innate charisma that very few of those guys have. I think they could translate to other cultures in one way or the other. We'll get onto that as we go along through the show. Anything I want to add is touch about the MMA stuff Carl's talking about. It does drive me insane. This match, It's more forgiving on it because it's Sakuraba and what Sakuraba's meant to.
It's Japan, it is a different culture.
Yeah, but exactly what Sakuraba's meant to that, to MMA and pro wrestling in that country. So it's a different beast. So I'll let it slide with Sakuraba. But Striker and JR, for me, it was, again, it was the big up and the props that these guys, wow, these are real MMA fights. And it's like, you're just selling your own brand of fighting, whatever JR called it, sure. And they went down the American way of putting over MMA to pro wrestling, and I just wonder how it comes across in Japan, how it's sold in Japan. It's that's, talk about lost in translation, that's something I'd be curious to find out, really.
Just want to clarify with the Sakuraba thing, it's just like, I probably think like the reason why I just find it hard to watch now is, I think, is ever since he got that injury where he broke his arm and stuff, just to me
super explained the guy.
He just comes across as like so fragile to me now when he's in the ring.
He doesn't seem like the right one. What do you think?
What do you think? Because he's already faced Nagata. He's already now done Suzuki, Shibata, I guess. But there's other people who, the only other people he could face are in other programs, got like higher up the card than him. And I don't know. I don't know what direction he's in. I think JR definitely wasn't in his comfort zone for these first four matches, including the Suzuki match, because it came across a little bit more like Striker
definitely led the commentaries.
That's a much better way of putting it.
He can't help himself one way or another, Striker.
And I think, like, you know, it started to change when we go into section two of these next three matches, and then by the time we get to, like, you know, the key ones towards the end, like, JR was kind of getting into stride. He knows who he's talking about now because he's most likely met these people before the show, and he got a lot more comfortable.
I'd love to see him call all the New Japan shows this year and then see him do the next Wrestle Kingdom show. I think that'd be, I'd really like to see that.
This one went 9 minutes 21 seconds. We move on to Togi Makabe defeating Tomohiro Ishii for the NEVER Championship, a result which shocked me, but the first real prominent match as it felt on the show. Again, very keen to hear the mixed reactions around this table, if they are mixed indeed. Ishii is one of my favourites, stunned at the finish, but Jesus Christ, these two beat the living shit out of each other.
I'm seen a bit of Ishii before. I like Ishii,
he's great.
He stands out. Not down, it was best match at this point in the show for me.
Yeah, easily, I thought.
And this is when I felt JR was really starting to warm up a bit more.
I was going to say this is what the again. I mentioned he started to find his groove a little bit in the previous one, but this was the one where it was like, okay, now he's got something he can really talk about, because this is something he can actually relate to a lot more.
Well, he can. It's sort of that that smash mouth style,
a horse fest.
That's it. You can just picture JR getting into the real physicality of the bout, and it was. It was comfortably up to that point the best match on the show, that goes without saying. It is one of those matches that sometimes I get a little bit uncomfortable watching, not necessarily as a knock on the two individuals, because I thought anything was poor or anything like that. It's more the physical nature of it sometimes even has me flinching a bit, you know. The way they sort of lace in those clotheslines.
Oh, they were the lariats
the
are just
forearms,
evil.
And it's just... it's done with almost such brutality, or such disregard for each other's bodies, that even me, with the sort of the bloodlust I can get from time to time, made me feel a little bit uncomfortable.
You had a catchphrase at several points in the show, Carl. If you want to burst out here.
My catchphrase for the show was, it's a work. And I think this was the first time I used it.
Yeah, usually said with a shriek.
Yeah, usually said with a shriek at my sort
it's
of...
it's a work!
Because I felt their pain, Kieran. On, as I was watching it, I felt their pain. Those lariats to the chest hurt my chest.
What about the chop to the throat earlier on? I dug that. That was good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
What about the lariat at the end when Ishii just crumbled on the floor? It didn't even take any...
Crumbled in a heap.
Heap.
Very much like the proverbial car wreck.
Absolutely. Curious to see, first of all, G, what you think of the match itself before you even delve into the finish, the outcome, the title change.
I think this is the first one where I think even you would admit this is the one where we kind of started kind of going, you know, slap hands together and go, right, now we're starting with the business end of the show now. We're getting to, like, you know, the players. At first I wasn't sure about, like, Togi being Ishii's opponent for this show. Mainly due to my opinion of Togi, my general disgust at this overrated man. I'm gonna be nice. I don't rate him personally. But I recognise at the same time because Ishii, as I said, that tough style that he does, where he beats the crap out of people, for him to really be showcased on the show, he needed to face someone who's willing to go the distance with him, and it's
higher up on the card than him.
Yeah, and in fairness to, and is a name. Yeah, I put a former champion as well. And in fairness to Togi, he's that guy. So yeah, I was actually kind of quite pleasantly surprised at the match. I mean, Ishii kind of, you know, got something out of him, as again, because I don't rate Togi at all.
He held up his end.
He held up his end, of course he did.
And we were watching in a rather large group. This was definitely the first match. I was almost going to say the one match, but that's not fair. But it was certainly the first match where people sort of started to lose their inhibitions a bit and really get caught up in it, I felt, within the room.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we had quite a mixed crowd as well watching it with us, and also, let's not forget, Luke Edwards was there.
Yes, our well. Comrade on the show.
Yeah, so, in terms of the result, I think you and I differ on this from our post-show talk. So,
neither of us liked it, but...
Yeah, I really, really didn't like it. I didn't think... I don't quite get...
You made that perfectly clear in the room.
Yeah, I don't quite get... I don't quite get what they're going to do with Togi and that belt. I don't quite get it. Well, you seem a lot more positive about Ishii losing this belt.
Because I think just to explain my perspective here before you get your response, I think it can go one of two ways. I think that it's either going to be he's going to move on up to something else, or the more likely scenario is that the NEVER title is basically going to become, for Ishii, what the IC belt is for Nakamura, which is Ishii's going to hold it, he's going to lose it and get it back. He's going to hold it, he's going to lose it and get it back. He did it with Yujiro Takahashi and he got it back. I think he's going to do it here. It means more if he has to chase the established champion and then he beats him and then he gets his belt back. The belt means more, he means more, the win means more. I don't think this is writing off Ishii, is basically the point.
If that's the way they're going to go about it, where they're going to try and create that NEVER belt with what they did with Nakamura and the IC... then that's great. I'll go for that. But I think, like, initially you had much more of an optimism of, like, you know, it's kind of like almost a Bret Hart SummerSlam 92 where he's like, he's losing the belt because he's going to get pushed up. And for me, I'm not quite so confident in that. And it's not because, like, I love Ishii. He's in my top five performers in that company, but it's just, it seems
like my fave fan.
With Ishii, they have kind of failed at times to really kind of pull the trigger on Ishii, for me anyway. They seem to be really slow. Maybe that's just the style of Japanese, how they push their stars over there. That's all cool. This guy isn't young. He hasn't got all the time in the world, you know, and it's just like they're taking so long with him. And so when he loses a belt like that, it doesn't suddenly inspire me to think, oh, they're going to push him. It's just like he's just lost a belt on the biggest show of the year. So it doesn't come across as like, oh, his future's bright. It just comes across as he's lost a belt on the biggest show of the year. He's the loser. And they've given it to someone with half the talent who shouldn't have been their heavyweight champion anyway, who I don't think is going to do as much with the belt as Ishii did.
How did you feel? Did you feel there was too many titles on the show?
I'm not a big fan of the NEVER Championship even existing, to be quite honest. I think the NEVER belt always felt like one too many, especially when you got two junior belts.
I appreciate, again, that I don't watch the product you know, month after month, and it is their biggest show of the year, so the title's going to be on there. But I, you know, it's like one minute you got the junior tags and it's the junior singles, and you got the regular tag. It's just so, it just seemed that every, it was another title, and it just,
yeah. And I will say to that point, because I do think they do a fantastic job with the singles belts for the most part, but the junior belts for the last few years have really taken a tumble as the divisions haven't been focused on that much, and the belts themselves very much feel like they're, even the world tag titles for a long period of time felt like they were just kind of there on the card, you know, the Killer Elite squad and Ten Cozy feud that went on for fucking decades.
I do
agree with that. I think there are too many belts.
I had a whole thing about, like, about these next two title matches, which are the junior heavyweight title and the heavyweight tag titles. So I'll probably go more into detail there about what my thoughts are about those particular belts.
Moving along, that was the intermission followed by Kenny Omega with the Young Bucks defeating Ryosuke Taguchi for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship in 13 minutes 20 seconds. These poor bastards had to follow Ishii and Makabe, and I am not envious of them having to go out there and do that. Thoughts are on the table of this. Kenny Omega, the cleaner looking with his new hairdo, his Scotty Flamingo tribute hair.
I think me and Carl are kind of consciously not trying to give the wrong impression of negativity, but again, Kenny Omega to me, again, a talented guy in spurts, but as an overall worker character, again, low rent. The name's low rent.
Oh, that's gonna piss.
There's low rent. I don't give a fuck. I sent my email address if you want to email me personally. He's fine. He, you know, there wasn't a bad match. He doesn't offend me in the ring, but as an overall character and performer, not for me personally.
So you didn't love the toothpick?
You didn't love the chainsaw in the ring?
The chainsaw and Matt Stryker's description of the chainsaw.
Okay, the fact that he actually interrupted Jim Ross to explain about how he shaves his arms. It's like, and then that spot on this show with the Credible Wrestling Elsewhere started like a neon light in a dog's asshole. It was just so, it felt so out of place.
Considering it's what's supposed to be the prestige of the junior heavyweight title as well. Yeah, the thing is, when I saw that, the first thought that popped into my head was Homer in the Simpsons movie when he's pretending to have the chainsaw at the door to keep the arms away. Yeah, that's exactly where my mind went. So that shows you the sort of the reverence I had for that little stint.
Since when did cleaners use chainsaws?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't know. The cleaners are
clean a bush.
From the look of his hair on top of his
there you go.
How much he takes care of his bush.
But it was
so the match.
Yeah, that bit aside, it was a good match. I did like JR's little throwaway remark about the ref when one of the young bucks has clearly got a hold of the guy's ankle. Yeah. Right in front of the referee, you know.
I understand that. What was it? He said something like that,
he
right?
He goes, "That's the referee can see that. I don't understand it."
Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
This was the match as well when Stryker said used the swerve line.
Was it here?
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
yeah,
I don't,
yeah, it was. Yeah.
And JR went off on him. So
I don't understand that word.
I've never been swerved in my life.
He lied to the fans. That's what it is. He lied to the fans.
Yeah, Jim put him in his place in that one, but no, it was an enjoyable match. But I do understand what Kieran's saying about the character aspect of Kenny Omega. I mean, some of the facials and when you combine it with like the toothpick and the hair getup and the chainsaw thing, it does come across a bit low rent, and it's a shame for what was a good match.
Yeah, actually, I'm keen to hear what people think about Ryosuke Taguchi, because he's been in a position before where when he's in feature matches, it always feels to me like the crowd's not really completely always with it. And he's taken on a bit more of an Eddie Guerrero look and style, very obviously, recently. But I thought this was kind of a big match for him in the sense of if he can put on a good performance, Omega 2, on the big stage and feel like he's not low rent, to use your words, Carl, both of them, then I thought it could be a bit of a breakout night. As it turns out, I did enjoy the match, but it was, again, that kind of sense of there was so much in the match that just didn't play into anything. Very similar to the first match on the show, the junior style maybe creeping in, but it's that thing of he sprays ice spray in his eyes and it doesn't really go anywhere. The Young Bucks are at ringside, interfering, doesn't really go anywhere, heel wins clean anyway. It's you know what I mean? It's just like there wasn't really a whole lot of consequence to what was actually going on point by point.
And the spray thing is certainly not something I would have expected to see from any match on the card, really. You don't associate shenanigans like that with the Japanese product.
Well, this is the thing. Yeah, they've been doing this a lot with the Bullet Club for the last couple of years, where it's become like their excuse to use kind of a lot of interference and chairs and stuff like that. And that Americanized element, and of course the fans don't like it. So,
if I'm honest, it would be hard for me to give an honest answer to that, given the little that I have seen. Help me with the name.
Kenny Omega? Ryosuke Taguchi.
Thank you, Taguchi. I'm struggling for the same for Taguchi there. I kept wanting to say
Tajiri.
not Tajiri. I was thinking
Sato.
I was thinking more the company. I was thinking more the company in Die Hard, but
Nakatomi,
there you go. But no, it would be hard for me to say in truth because I haven't seen enough of him, so it would be difficult for me to say, oh, he came across like a star to that crowd, because I don't really know how they've reacted to his other stuff. That you and G would have a better idea on that than me.
Yeah, similar to yourself, Carl. I wouldn't feel fair evaluating how much either it did for either of them, because I'm not familiar with the recent product. But watching afresh the two guys, they were two or three steps below
Everyone else in the second half of the card?
Yeah, really. Even Taguchi's look
didn't hook you.
It didn't hook me. It didn't. Neither guy stood out, or the feud or the match stood out like it was a particularly big deal compared to other things.
One person that did stand up for was Linus from the UK fan forum. He said, "With zero emotional attachment to any of the matches, my favourite as a standalone contest was the junior heavyweight bout between Kenny Omega and Ryusuke Taguchi. The only Kenny Omega match I'd ever seen before this was against a 9-year-old girl, so I was pleasantly surprised by this. The two main events were good, and I can understand if you follow the stories how they mean so much more, but this was the most fun for me." Gee, do you want to step in with this? Any thoughts on this match?
Yeah, I mean, first off, obviously, they were going to have trouble following Ishii. It wasn't as good as I was hoping from those two, because I do like them. I like both of them, particularly Omega. They didn't quite live up to what I imagined those two could do. When they signed Omega, I was happy about it. I mean, they did do some good signings last year with Omega, Ibushi, AJ Styles. And so I was excited to have Omega in the company as a full-time wrestler, and then they instantly put him with the Bullet Club. I was like, ah, shit, you know, this isn't going to be good. This isn't going to be good for him. And I think that's probably what one of my two main problems was with this match, which is the Bucks being at ringside. I like Omega, but I for one am entertained by Omega, and I think that he can be very colourful and entertaining. To the extent where he doesn't need the Bucks at ringside. He doesn't need the Bullet Club. And so because of that, because he had to change his gimmick, I think if he kept to what he was doing best, which was in like DDT or other kind of indie companies, where he's just playing this very kind of brash, arrogant, over-the-top, incredibly cheesy kind of heel, I think that would have been entertaining and it would have worked. By him instantly, you know, just go dressing all in black and, you know, with a Razor Ramon toothpick and being with Bullet Club and just all that stuff, it kind of, in my personal opinion, devalues him a lot from what he's able to do. I think he could be a great character in that company. I don't think he needs to be like a Brian Pillman, which I think JR referenced on the show. He doesn't need to be that because he was something different when he was in DDT. In fairness, what this new character that Omega's doing, I'm going to give it time, because I think probably given time, Omega might make it work, but I don't think it's what they should have done with him. That was my first problem with the match. My second problem is just like the legitimacy of Taguchi, to be honest with you. To me, he just comes across as a transitional champion and just like a placeholder for when they find someone who's better. Because, I mean,
he's always come off like that too, which is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, for many years when he was in Apollo 55 or Prince Devitt, he was the second guy. You know, he was just a sidekick, you know, because it was Devitt who won the junior heavyweight title and also with him won the junior heavyweight tag titles as well. I think he was good as maybe a one half of a tag team or being a challenger, but I don't buy him as champion. So for me, like, the entire match was just a foregone conclusion that it was going to be Omega, because ever since Devitt's left, because Devitt kind of dominated that division for 8 years and kind of carried it for the majority of that time. And ever since he left, you know, it came across like Ibushi, to mention a name who comes up later on, it looked like Ibushi was going to take over from Devitt as being the keystone of that division. And then he turned out to be so fucking awesome, they decided to push him up into the main event scene. So now they're kind of thinking, well, we need someone else. And so they thought about his tag team partner, Kenny Omega, which is, I think, is a good choice. I think given the time, he could be, in a different sense, he could be like Devitt in terms of dominating that division. But Taguchi as a champion, I don't quite buy. So it was just a foregone conclusion for me.
When you're going from a product where the juniors have very much always been in the junior heavyweight division, they've always sort of been...
Segregated.
Yes, they're an island unto themselves. Whereas over the last, people may be able to argue with me here, I have a better knowledge of the product, but I would say from what I've sort of seen, read, you know, whatever sort of brief bits I have seen, over the last sort of 6 or 7 years, it's transitioned from a point where your junior heavyweight guys are now at the top of the card. And it's not easy just to plug in that gap. You know, if it was that easy, everyone would have done it. If it was that easy to get a top guy in the WWF and a new top guy, they'd have done it. You know, it's never straightforward to try and plug in those gaps.
The seventh match on the show, Hirooki Goto and Katsuyori Shibata defeated Doc Gallows and Carl Anderson in the Bullet Club in 9 minutes to become the IWGP World Tag Team Champions. Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum says, I was almost tempted to say the Bullet Club versus the Super Best Friends was my favourite match. It was the match I was most emotionally invested in, with over a year of story supporting it, and I loved the demolition job they did on Gallows at the end. It was the only match where I had zero doubt as to who was winning, but I didn't care because the result made me so happy. Arn Anderson was referenced quite a few times here, Carl. Do you see Arn Anderson in Machine Gun Carl?
No, I do not.
Ah, very brief. But I do like Carl Anderson, though.
Yeah,
I'd need to see more to really form an opinion on him as a worker. But I think that the reference to the to Arn Anderson ties into what Kieran was getting to earlier, in that if there were moments where JR would struggle, he would fall back on sort of old stories, or he would reach for things that were more of a comfort level. And I think that was a prime example there. This was one of those matches to me where I really felt a disconnect between me watching it and not having that understanding of the product, and not your emailer referenced it there about the sort of the build, if you like, and JR and Striker on commentary kept referring to the fact that Goto and Shibata.
Yeah,
I keep going to say Chiabata, folks. This is so difficult for me. Shibata, yeah?
Yeah.
Thank you. They kept referencing on commentary this notion of them not winning the big one.
Yeah.
Or always falling at the last hurdle, if you like. And with me not having been invested in the product prior to that, it was really hard to get invested in this match. It's not a knock on the match itself. If anything, it's just a complete knock on me, but it was something I struggled to really grasp any significance of it.
I will also, to that point, and that's spoken from the, you know, first-time viewer eyes, I'll say from not the first-time viewer eyes, the reason why it didn't feel as climactic to me as it maybe did for the person who gave the feedback there, the IWGP tag belts have not been held in high esteem for quite some time now. They haven't been prominent, and the fact that, you know, they can't win the big one, it doesn't feel, I feel like Shibata is capable of so much more than just the tag belts. Goto is completely underrated, and people do think he's very good, but he's very underrated still. And I just, this is like the big climactic moment. It's cool, the story of them is like, you know, friends in high school and stuff like that, who trained together and all that stuff, and it did make for a nice narrative. This is one of those points, actually, that I want to get into a little bit, as the thing that was kind of missing that we usually get at the Tokyo Dome, I'm guessing was cut for time, was the video packages, which they only did for the last two, and the very special entrances they used to do all throughout the show, which there really was, with the exception of Nakamura, who that was just because he dressed differently.
They were really far into the matches, through the show. The first three were lightning, but guys out, next guys in, real fast turnaround.
Really fast turnaround. Even the little things, like we usually see for the IC title and the world title, they'll play like the ceremonial video where they show the previous champions. They didn't even do that. Yeah, it's just like the little things like that that they skipped out to save time.
Yeah.
Hurt that kind of storytelling element of why people like us for the first time would see why Shibata, you know, didn't quite get there. Goto hasn't quite gotten there. Yeah. These guys have been friends through high school. Last year at Wrestle Kingdom they wrestled, which I'm not even sure if they referenced on commentary.
They didn't, because this is what I was going to say. That's how I watched them. They were feuding with each other, and I was waiting for some kind of reference, and there was absolutely nothing. Yeah. Like, and you know, the backstory about there being, you know, friends from school and all that jazz was great, but I felt a little superficial because they didn't even touch on when they feuded, and I just, yeah, that was something that stuck out to me anyway.
Yeah, as a match, it was very fun. I did enjoy it quite a bit. Again, because it was only 9 minutes, they were moving pretty quick in there. Mm-hmm. Again, because it was quick, it wasn't really as great a showcase as it could have been. It wasn't as good a match as I think those four guys could do together. Especially with, you know, three of the four being very, very good and Gallows being okay in spots. But you seem unimpressed by the Gallows reference there, Carl.
I just, when it comes to Gallows, it's unfair on him, but I just can't get past Biscuits and Gravy.
Yeah, you were even singing that.
And then, you know, Shibata has just been, I put him in a similar vein to Ishii in the last couple of years, where it seems like it almost feels like he's been held down at times when he should be at the top of the card. In terms of this match, I kind of knew this was like another foregone conclusion for me. I knew this was like, Goto and Shibata got to be winning this, surely.
And so, like, the match itself, I thought was decent. It was entertaining for the short period of time it is. I fully expect that there will be a rematch, and so there'll be more time given to him on future shows to do this. You were just shocked a moment ago when we were just talking off air about, like, I told you that in the commentary as well, they mentioned that Machine Gun and Gallows won these tag belts on the previous Wrestle Kingdom show.
Yeah.
So they've actually held them for a year. Okay,
and we had no idea.
Yeah, you had no idea, and we're actually trying to think of when it actually did anything significant with those tag belts. They never did. The last time I remember those tag belts being significant was back when it was Bad Intentions that hold the tag belts, which is
Carl Anderson and Lord Tenzai.
Yeah, and Giant Bernard, as he was known over there to everyone else, A Train. That they were a good tag team. They held those tag team belts, if I remember roughly right, for about 2 years, and they actually dominated that division. During one of those 2 years, the G1 Tag Team Climax, which they won. Oh, yeah.
Was that a different kind of pay-per-view on Sunday night.
Different type of pay-per-view.
Different Japanese videos. Well. Yeah.
I was just wondering if that girl from earlier in the show that Kieran liked so much made an appearance.
Yeah, probably did, yeah. That was the last time I remember those tag belts, or at least the tag champions, being something important on the show. Ever since then, they've just been in free fall. That's the only thing with this win with Goto Shibata. There's two ways to look about it. You're either looking like, oh shit, are they going to just sideline these guys with two belts that don't really mean anything? And are they just going to be ending up facing Killer Elite Squad and Machine Gun Anderson and Gallows? And Anderson deserves better because he's good. Are they just going to be like sidelined with these tag titles for the next like year and a half or whatever? Or is this actually going to be the beginning where they're going to use Goto and Shibata to put these belts back over again?
Yeah, some actual really strong pairings and use these as like, okay, in tag team competition, these guys are fucking unbeatable or something like that.
Yeah.
Moving along to section three, according to G. John Chase. Actually,
yes. Section C, now we're getting hot.
I believe that's how it's going to be put on the DVD cover as well.
I believe so. AJ Styles defeated Tatsuya Naito in 14 minutes and 25 seconds. Pretty damn good match, I thought. Again, this was following off from the Ishii Makabe match, as my favourite up to this point. I thought this was a hell of a good match. I don't think it was as good as the one they had in the G1 late last year, but again, AJ's just been on fire since he came to New Japan, and Naito, the aforementioned Naito, who actually, I want to see what your thoughts are on Tetsuya Naito actually across the table.
I've never been a massive fan. He doesn't offend me. Apart from looking like a ginger Japanese Robert Gibson. But I'm a massive AJ fan. I think, I was expecting like a blowaway match, and it was a good match. It was a really good match, but it wasn't. I was hoping for a blowaway match. Naito.
How about that dropkick on the floor?
Yeah, that's great.
That was good. That was brutal, but it was good.
That may have been the second time where I screamed, "It's a word."
Which was probably followed by the third time when AJ got backdropped to the floor and just ate it.
So painful, because it was almost like it's a bit like sort of cartoon-esque in the sense that you almost hear the splat when they hit the floor in both instances. As a match, really enjoyed it. I thought Naito's a sort of first impressions go for me. I can't say that I thought he put a foot wrong.
But no, I'm sure, he was really good.
I'm sure people have probably seen other matches because they can point to that they say were better. More power to those people. AJ, having not seen him wrestle for a while, probably in his waning days in TNA, just looks completely rejuvenated.
Yes.
Completely rejuvenated. And then the business is better for it. I'm not going to say it's a game changer on the landscape or anything like that, but it's so enjoyable to watch an AJ Styles who's firing on all cylinders. And the interesting thing here again was, because it was someone that JR was familiar with, he seemed more engaged again to me.
He's more genuine, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was more genuine. He's heard of the Pele kick. That's Pele.
How did he pronounce it?
Not Pele, as our friends across the pond tend to pronounce it. Pele kick. One more time. But no, it may seem insignificant, but the little things like that, where JR is really clued in, and he's just more engaged, and it gives it a little bit more sizzle on the steak, if you like.
Yeah. I think, again, Naito, who got kind of the... I don't know if I would even call it a raw deal. Last year he won the G1 Climax and was supposed to the main event against Okada for the world title when Okada was champ. And the fans, well, they voted him out of the main event and they put him on, they put him on second to last because they voted Tanahashi and Nakamura to go on last for the IC belt over them. And Naito hasn't really been treated like a top guy ever since. He obviously, you know, in this match with AJ Styles, did the job. AJ going towards a match with Tanahashi for the World Championship, it looks like.
Interesting watching AJ with the longer hair and maybe, again, being concerned because he knows he just has to go out and wrestle, but he was a lot more insular, didn't project as much, hardly saw his face with the hair. So it was quite interesting, and I think he probably felt more comfortable because he's not the most...
naturally extroverted, charismatic.
Yeah,
guy.
Exactly. And I think he kind of got a kick out of that. Let's just do what I'm good. I'm great at. But it was interesting watching him.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That was the first thing I agree with you, Carl. It was the first thing I.
What is going on this show?
I know. I'm sorry. In terms of his thoughts of AJ feeling rejuvenated, Naito, man, that guy gets such a hard rap, and it's been like misfire after misfire with him. Not always his fault. It just seems to be a lot of wrong place, wrong time for him almost here and there in the last few years, because he is a really good talent. I do like him. You know, we talked about the spots with the drop kick, which he's done similar versions of that before in other matches, and it's always entertaining. And I was expecting probably maybe a little bit more than what they delivered on that show, knowing how well they performed in the G1 last year, but to say that I didn't enjoy it is wrong.
Just as a curious thing, Styles is getting the title shot against Tanahashi in February, and Dave Meltzer on the Observer show yesterday said to expect a title change, so maybe AJ is going to be the champion again, apparently. Yeah. Intercontinental Championship match, Shinsuke Nakamura defeated Kota Ibushi, a G1 rematch from 2 years ago, which did surpass expectations. 20 minutes. This is before we actually get into our own thoughts around the table. This was the most chosen match for a match of the night. Undefeated Steak from the UK Fan Forum. Had I answered this last night, I'd have said Ishii versus Makabe. I watched this match again tonight, and it wasn't quite as good as I initially thought. Ibushi versus Nakamura was incredible on every level, from the timing, the pacing, and the general structure, to Nakamura's unmatched charisma and the making of Ibushi as a star. It was everything a wrestling match should be, and then some. CSL from TPWW Forums also says Nakamura and Ibushi because it was the best match I've seen this year. Admittedly, it's the only wrestling show I've watched this year, but still, best match I've seen in a while, and I'm far from the biggest Strong Style fan. Air Raid, as much as his favourite was the actual tag match with the Super Best Friends, as you said earlier, Nakamura versus Ibushi was the best. It was the match I looked forward to the most and had the memory of their first match from Osaka in the 2013 G1 to contend with, and it somehow managed to eclipse my expectations. Even though I predicted that Nakamura would retain, they suspended my disbelief to the point that I believed Ibushi could beat him, and at points that he would. And though Shinsuke looked the boss by winning such a tough match, Ibushi looked stronger in defeat, and that's a tough balance at times. Nakamura is both a living example that someone truly can be a top guy for years without holding the top title, and an example that your secondary title can be made to look like a big deal if the right people hold and compete for it. There's another couple of votes here. Colin Bollocks! Nakamura versus Ibushi is his favourite match. Wonderfully executed and told a great story. Plus, Nakamura dressed sort of like the Statue of Liberty. I thought JR did a really good job making both wrestlers seem like a big deal during this one too. Innovator from TPWW also says Nakamura and Ibushi hands down. Nakamura was tremendous in all aspects on that night. And Smelly Meatball from TPWW also says Nakamura and Ibushi, great match in the ring. And JR hyping up the IC belt as a huge deal to own is refreshing compared to what gets done in the WWE. And Mike Adamley also votes, I hope it's the real guy, says Nakamura and Ibushi, so far fucking hard hitting, and Ibushi showed me a new side that I didn't know he had. And finally, Ian Drew Dice Clay from the UK Fan Forum. Nakamura versus Ibushi was obviously the best match of the night, but I feel a million people are going to say that, so I'm going to say Scott D'Amore's Bullet Club dinner jacket was the best thing all night. Just to move away from D'Amore's dinner jacket and onto the match itself. Thoughts on Nakamura versus Ibushi around the table, because obviously this is, for me anyway, the match of the night.
Yeah, definitely for me. I mean, when they announced the card, you know, although I knew Okada Tanahashi was going to be great, this was the match that interested me the most, because as the writer, the emailer in, said, they had a great match 2 years ago or a year and a half ago at the G1, And so I was just like, we never got that rematch. So I was just looking at this thinking, okay, this is a little bit different, where like the main event, we got two established guys who have main evented Wrestle Kingdom before, you know, having a rematch, so to say. Here, we got something different where like Ibushi, the new guy, is going after, you know, the established star. And JR, he was absolutely right. This is for me where JR really kind of like really woke up now. He was just talking about this all the way through, talking about how it's like the young guy going up against the established star. And he was just like, even though like early in the match when Ibushi's showing quite heel tendencies early on, like just JR's just there going, I like this. I like this kid because he's not afraid of him. He's not intimidated by him. He's going to go after Nakamura. He wants to win this belt. And he's kept pushing and putting over Ibushi as being this really tough young guy. And
at
actually,
the same time, and the way that the dynamic played out, by doing that, he was elevating Nakamura the entire time. So yeah. Nakamura is fantastic. And there was one point when Stryker said, Nakamura doesn't feel there's any competition. And GR just chimed in and said, yeah, you might be right. He might be that good.
Yeah. It's, I mean, he just mentioned it all the time. I mean, with Ibushi saying like how, you know, this boy's turning into a man and stuff like that, and he's like, you know, he's raising his game. And then you know, during Nakamura's entrance, where like JR just goes on this whole like this skit about like this, like he's the most unique individual you're gonna see in professional wrestling, and that's, you know. You know, he's mentioning like was it Freddie Mercury and Michael Jackson. Yeah. And he's just saying like, oh, you know, like he's kind of quirky and he has different entrances, but he's also a badass. And he goes, do you get that, folks? You know, so he's charismatic and he's quirky, but he's badass as well. You're gonna see two sides of this character. Absolutely, for me, delivered. Emotionally, I was very into the main event, but this one, in terms of a moment by moment in the match, was the one that had me the most. I just absolutely loved it. Nakamura, you know, you can't say enough about the guy of how good he is, right, from his psychology and everything. And I thought, from compared to some of the issues I've had with him when we were talking in the G1 Climax about certain bits of sloppiness in his game, I thought he was absolutely crisp on that night, and really showcased himself as probably being the best all-rounder on that show.
In the world,
yeah. But for me, however good Nakamura was in that match, the person that I walked away with, just with the utmost respect, was Ibushi. Physicality, I mean, I really like him. He does the aerial manoeuvres like he always does, but he's also changed his game. He's bulked up a little bit. He's working on his strikes as well, making them look as vicious as possible. And, you know, these two guys are going back and forth, kicking the shit out of each other. So much so, at one point, it was so brutal. I don't necessarily agree with whether Nakamura should have retained it or not. I don't mind that he did. I think this could have been Ibushi's night. To really kind of push him and elevate him, but I'm not offended by Nakamura retaining.
Thoughts on the other side?
Yeah, it was my favourite match of the show. I thought this was really felt like the first real big match to me, and Nakamura by far and away the biggest star on the show so far. I've got an issue with, I think people are very hyperbolic when it comes to charisma in Japanese wrestling. I think Nakamura stands out because most people on the card have zero that we're conventionally used to as North American pro wrestling fans, whereas Nakamura's got something that you could take him and put in any country, in any company, anywhere, and he could do this exactly the same thing and still get over. And he's phenomenal, obviously, in the ring as well. Ibushi, I like Ibushi a lot. He seems, I might be completely off on this one, but I can imagine him being like Tanahashi. Like a young Tanahashi, kind of when Tanahashi on the rise.
Yeah.
I just imagine that's how he was. I don't know if he was or wasn't.
No, that's
good. But I imagine he's got that feel to me. He feels like he could be something special you could build around him. I like Ibushi.
Yeah.
Really like the match again. JR, I thought he was at his best in this match. I thought he was better in this match than he was in the main event.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was the simple story of the vet and the new guy. And maybe that resonated to me because it felt like, you know, watching the Kobashi and Misawa stuff, it is a similar, you know, it's something that it's the legacy stuff, and the veteran and the new guy stuff, is it's a story that the Japanese tell better than anywhere else. I think they just do it time and time again. It's like it's a respect thing, maybe. So I just think that connected. It seemed natural. It was a natural story JR could get his teeth into. Again, the character of Ibushi being the young guy, he could get behind it without, I don't know if he's ever seen the guy before, but he doesn't need to. He knew the story to get behind for him. And Tanahashi, Nakamura, he knows, obviously he knew, and he knows a bit about, enough about it to really get behind him as well. So I really enjoyed the match.
Suffice to say, we've got a clean sweep on best match of the night. I'm in complete agreement with everyone here. I appreciate what Kieran's saying in terms of the charisma by sort of contrast to the rest of the roster. But I can't help but feel, even with my sort of novice eyes, if you like, that you're possibly just underselling him a touch there.
Maybe I think, I'm reacting to how much love he gets from everyone else, I think.
There's no one that comes even remotely close to him as an individual when it comes to the charisma aspect. It was almost oozing out of every pore of his body. I was really impressed with him from a charismatic standpoint. I agree with what you said before about I think you could pick him up and put him anywhere in the world, and it's a charisma that translates, that gets over with any audience. I was thoroughly impressed with the guy. It was a fantastic match. I'm not sure if we're all in agreement on this one, but I would echo the sentiment that I thought this was JR at his peak on the night.
Yeah.
Because, as you've already said, the young upstart and the veteran is such a natural story, and the Japanese have done it fantastically throughout, you know, the annals of time. Through the annals of time. Thank you for that correction, good sir. But yeah, it was one that
is that in the video store next to Tag Team Climax?
You go to the same Blockbuster.
Both men came out of it looking like $1 million. You can come out of a match looking like a star with a loss if it's done right.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to say on that as well. I haven't really talked too much about like the booking of and finishes of matches because, you know, with the lack of familiarity. But this for me. I thought it was actually the right decision, because just with the Japanese mindset, when if Ibushi goes and beats him, it will elevate him. That's the sign that then he's progressed, he's improved, and it works. So then they can get that story across. So and seeing that it was a step up to Nakamura for him, I thought it was in that setting and in that company the right finish.
Piggybacking on Kieran's point somewhat there, it would seem somewhat disingenuous for me to talk about booking decisions and directions with my limited knowledge of the current product, but I would just pose a question for Yuji and Liam as regular watchers of it. You've mentioned earlier in the podcast about Ishii possibly being held down, and also the sense of Naito being held down. There's only so many top spots that can go around.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, if Nakamura drops the belt then, what would you have done with him going forward? I mean, surely that same rule applies. You mentioned about you thought this might have been the time for Ibushi to win the belt, but then
Nakamura,
by logical extension, you've then got to push Nakamura up, surely, because you can't push that man down the card.
No.
I guess probably in my mindset, why I thought that now would have been a good time, it's probably the Okada booking that I probably got in my mind, because Okada didn't go through the same thing as everybody else where they built him up slowly. Okada came in.
He was the exception, though.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably the reason why. He was the exception, because he's fantastic. But he came in on a Wrestle Kingdom, then won the belt on the next show. Oh, you mentioned like the similarity to Tanahashi, which I absolutely agree with. I do see that in Ibushi. I think he's going to be a big star for them, particularly in the main event scene. I don't know, maybe I just saw something in him where I thought, like, if you give him the ball, even if it's as soon as this, I think he can run with it, because he's really talented. I thought he started showing a lot of character in that match as well, because he doesn't get the chance to show it much when he was in the junior heavyweights. In this match, you started to see a little bit more about him, whether it was a little bit of cockiness or whether he's like smiling, you know, after, you know, Nakamura's hit a move and it hasn't worked on him, and he's just like, there's just seemed to be a little bit more fire in him, a little bit more personality that we're seeing that will develop over time.
I think that's exactly why I think it was right for him. In the Japanese psychology and context, what is right for him not to, and coming from the juniors, because my familiarity was with him as a junior, and I'm not sure how long he's moved up, but the psychology and mythos in Japan of he's transitioning, yeah, and the actual like a tangible improvement when he then goes and beats Nakamura is something they can get over in, yeah, that always seems to work better in Japan. Assuming they're still going to go around again together maybe in a year's time, whatever, who knows, and build to it. Yeah, I think if, like Carl said, if Nakamura lost you're going to build a rematch with him? No, it wouldn't work that way around. Yeah. Build for the ongoing chasing.
Just kind of go back to the match, because you mentioned there's a point you made there about Ibushi, you know, not having a chance to show facial expressions and stuff in the juniors. Mm. He had the chance, he just didn't do it. The reason why I love this match, and it's the same thing, I mean, a couple of things here, and this is why I think Nakamura was fantastic, is the psychology of using Ibushi's skills. Because we've seen this with Ibushi, and one of my common complaints with the guy, as spectacular as he is as a flyer, is that junior hip mentality of doing so many damn flips, selling nothing. It's common with Ibushi. I've said it for a long, long time. Why did he rein it in? He reined it in the same reason he reined it in the G1 match with Nakamura, because Nakamura puts it in a position where he does his flying stuff early, and then there's a spot in this match which was a throwback to the first G1 match, where Nakamura is kicking him when he's on the floor, and Ibushi just stops taking shit. It was the same thing they did a couple of years ago, and Ibushi gets up and he starts throwing the palm strikes, he throws closed fist punches, which was great. Yeah. That Jim Ross mentioned, we don't see these in New Japan, this is great. And then he went for that big lariat, which he did at the end of the same spot 2 years ago, and Nakamura turned it into the flying armbar, which was awesome. And then Ibushi stamps on his face and he's just getting more and more physical.
I was just to jump in there quickly, just because I think it's pertinent with the tone in your voice. This to me was also the other match on the card, much like the Ishii match from earlier, where everyone seemed to sort of again let go of their inhibitions and become completely divested in what was going on.
Oh, everyone's
screen.
Screaming with every strike.
Yeah, I could just the way you were describing it there, it was almost as if you were reliving it there, and I just thought, yeah, this was the other match on the card where everyone just sort of just took that little extra bit of notes of what was happening.
I understand why they kept Nakamura and Tanahashi with the belts, because when you just described what Nakamura did with Ibushi did do a lot of those flips. It's probably kind of inherent from when he was in DDT, where he did a lot of silly gimmicks and so on. So he kind of needed a little bit of schooling. The talent is raw there, but he needed someone of Nakamura's class to kind of school him a little bit, which is actually, strangely enough, very similar to a few years ago when Tanahashi first worked with Okada.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Which now brings us very nicely to the main event of the show. It was Hiroshi Tanahashi, the IWGP World Heavyweight Champion, beating Kazuchika Okada in 30 minutes and 57 seconds, the longest match on the show. I did think Jim Ross was fantastic here, and a few other people did also mention that this was their favourite match of the show. Wyatt Sheepmask from the UK Fan Forum. Okada versus Tanahashi, much better than their match at Wrestle Kingdom 7. And Matt Yaxley emailed in and said, Tanahashi versus Okada was my match of the night, a classic wrestling match that didn't need the shock value violence that helped make a few of the other matches what they were. The crowd was going nuts from about the halfway mark, and everything they did was absolutely inch perfect. As much as I love Okada, Tanahashi just has a dramatic flair, somewhat similar to Bret Hart for me, in the sense that he pulls you in, that makes every big match he has mean so much more.
Because he can sell. Jesus Christ. Yeah, he's, as a working babyface, he's fantastic.
Yeah, he's
awesome. I mean, to talk about, everyone jumps on the Nakamura thing for charisma, but charisma, being able to communicate with the crowd, no one can touch Tanahashi when he's selling. He's fantastic. He's the closest thing. I rate Japanese wrestling on like a Kobashi scale, and that, and Kobashi just absolutely been a dream when it comes to selling. That's what made him so special. For me, and I see a bit of that in Tanahashi. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of little things he does with the act, like the little skip over the top rope.
When he's firing up for the high fly flow.
Yeah, yeah, and that little spinny clothesline.
Sling blade.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that at all. But that's just me picking liking moves, and that's just whatever, that's irrelevant. He's a fantastic babyface. My one thing I want to mention in this match, and it's the reason I want to mention it in this match, is again the law of diminishing returns, is a theme in the show where the guys stop and they do their man up, balls out, dick measuring, slapping around the face gimmick.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can be like a really dramatic spot, but I just found on this show they made it a cliche.
Oh, it's been a cliche in New Japan
and
for a while.
And it's just like dives over
the top. You should have seen the G1 climax when they were doing the forearms back and forth in almost every match.
And this one, I can't remember how it was going. I think maybe Tanahashi was kicking his ass. Or it might be the other way around, I can't remember. And then out of nowhere, it just slowed and they just kind of started doing it. And it wasn't as offensive in the final match. It was better done because the guys involved. But it's still just from a psychology. They just stop and they do the little slapping each other's faces, and it's really, it looks great. And you go, oh, but it's when it's done in every match, and the match just seems to stop, and everyone's no selling now, and it's like, okay, so everything we've just seen previously is now non-existent, it means absolutely nothing. It becomes a cliche, and it'd be much more dramatic in the final matches when they did it if they didn't do it in all the other matches as well.
It's just that, in some ways, it almost becomes like an isolated incident, yeah. Doesn't it? It does to a certain extent sort of devalue what has come prior to it in whichever match you're referring to. I think that the jumping over the top rope bit does that as well. That was something that irked me a bit during the match, especially because they were going,
what about the back?
Yes, yeah, I may have screamed once or twice, oh, so much for that bad back that he's got. But I suppose I'm being a bit pernickety there, let's say. Yeah. It was a very good match. You can tell again that JR was more invested. There were particular things he was looking out for, such as the Rainmaker pose for the clothesline, which he even tied in when Tanahashi was sort of taunting Okada.
Yeah, he did the same thing.
He was clearly looking out for the Okada dropkick. I think that was
highlight.
That was the most.
We're going to see the dropkick. He's so excited.
That was the most vocal he got throughout the entire evening, I think, as a sort of one-off incident, and it was the one time where I liked the use of numbers from JR. To tie into that sort of legitimate sporting element of it, the fact that he referenced the fact that that Tanahashi had more main event shows at the Tokyo Dome than anybody else.
He also mentioned
going through the point of listing other people's names to use as historical precedents.
Yeah,
you know, say, you know, this is how good this guy is. You know, X only did it this many times. Y only did it this many times. But Tanahashi has done it. This is the significance of the champion. This is how important he is. And he was just more invested in it. And when JR was more clued in, as we said before, it just added to that element of the match.
Just on that same point before you move on, Carl, I was going to say, mm-hmm. I also like the fact that Jim Ross, you talked about the series and how it's 3 to Okada, 2 to Tanahashi, 1 was a draw. This, you know, it playing the numbers in there as well. And also talking about, you know, even though it wasn't numbers specific, the history for the last year of the belt.
And also the notion that Tanahashi wasn't going to go for the title whilst Okada had the belt previously. You know, he was sort of the man enough to say, this guy's got my number, and they made a point of emphasising that, and it all just you know, it we talk about commentary being sort of the window dressing, and you never want it to be the story, but in instances where it's done correctly, it helps so much, particularly for someone like me who is a novice in terms of the current product. It really helps to make things seem more significant, but it was a really good match. That there were one or two things that I wasn't necessarily happy with, which I referenced before, which is why it doesn't get my sort of top match of the night. You know, I thought the frog splash was a bit of overkill there. I think they used sort of, I think it was 6 variations of it if we want to go there. But so there was a couple of things, there was a few reasons why it wasn't my top match, but nonetheless, those sort of points aside, another really good match, and it was nice to see that sort of the build-up, almost the way a card should be. You're getting to better matches as you're going on, and you're not dealing with a dead crowd by the main event.
Different styles in the undercard, the big matches feeling like big matches. Just to move... Oh, go ahead, Kieran. Is there anything you want to chime in?
I just want to ask Carl, what do you make of Okada? Because
this would be good, because, you love Okada, and I want to hear what these guys have to say.
Yeah, because I've got a very split opinion on myself.
What he did sort of move-wise and something was good. Everything was crisp. I didn't think of anything that I could maybe pick faults with, because I'm such a, you know, mat technician myself. but I put him a notch below Tanahashi, and I put him a notch below Nakamura. You mentioned about selling, and I didn't think he was sort of up there when it came to the selling to me.
Totally. Especially first half of matches for me, just his face, just there is nothing there. He looks like a wide-eyed kid, and he's doing his job. And yeah, by the end of the match, it's a great match. I'm not gonna knock that if he's super talented, but I just, for me, when you compare how like a Tanahashi emits emotion through his face, it, I just, until a match really gets deep, I just don't feel anything from Okada. He just...
It's actually funny that you mentioned this, because on the G1 Climax show we did last year, me and G were talking about this, and I said the one criticism I have of Okada is the fact that he looks like, for the first half of the match, he's on cruise control and his face just shows no sign of a struggle, really, yeah. Or anything like that.
I mean, I will say, he was brilliant at the end as he's being helped out, and
he was awesome.
The tears are
flowing. But by the end, he was fantastic.
He's absolutely awesome there. He's fantastic in that moment. But yeah, there is almost this sense of, as you say, cruise control, and he almost needs to sort of be kicked into gear to sort of show more of a range.
And it's, I think most times I've seen him, it's been the same. I've, you know, well, by the end of the match, super impressed. But every match, the first half of the match, I always think the same. God damn, show some fucking emotion of some description. One thing for you two guys is the New Japan hardcores. Whatever.
We're going back to Red Dawn territory.
The dynamic between Okada and Tanahashi in terms of how they cast as... Obviously, it's Japan, so that the face heel dynamic's different anyway. I just like... At the end, you got Okada crying. He's lost again. And Tanahashi's, like, apparently the translation was...
Rubbing it in, really?
Yeah, I'm still the man. Yeah. And I just...
Come back another day, Junior.
I need that explained to me.
Particularly because Tanahashi shows heel tendencies at times, and Okada, up until quite recently, would come across as quite babyface-esque. I know we don't like this term, and I don't fully agree with myself, but they almost come like tweeners at times, where like they don't see. I know,
tweener.
I know.
I'm going to say it because that's just my tweener just, means not over. So.
Yeah, but it just seems a bit weird. Don't think it was my favorite of their series. I'd rate personally Invasion Attack as my favorite that they've done, and also the first match they ever had. I can't remember the name. New Beginnings, I think it was. But I'll put this third on my list of their matches that they've had, particularly by the end, as you could noticeably tell, you're getting towards the closing here. My heart was starting to go towards the end. It was getting like fast, like beating faster and faster. I was thinking like, fuck, they're not going to give this to Okada, are they? And just like, I'm just waiting and waiting and waiting, and yeah, it just really had me kind of antsy towards the end. And in fairness, like we were talking about JR, and we'll probably go more into commentary in a bit. Yeah, he did. He was a lot better overall in the IC match. But and as Carl mentioned, when he mentions the drop kick, it kind of came. It was blatantly obvious that he put over the Rainmaker. But it's obvious that he's watched footage of Okada. He's seen the drop kick, and he's maybe turned around and said, like, right. So for anyone who's not familiar with this product, that's going to be a moment, right? He's looking for that Stone Cold moment, like that thing where you can just shout out whatever it is, right? And just really emphasize it, put the exclamation point on it. And it looked like he'd seen that drop kick and went, that's fucking it right there. And so as soon as he hits the drop kick, which is the best drop kick I've ever seen, it's just amazing every time he does it, he just goes off on one. And I'll tell you now, I watched everyone in that room, and there wasn't a single one of you that didn't have a huge smile on your faces when he started going, oh my god, look at that drop kick. I guess that's the highest drop kick I've ever seen.
No,
he
just goes, going, it was coming because of the foreshadowing. Yeah, so, okay.
You knew you were waiting for that Stone Cold moment from JR, and it happens, and everyone had a huge smile on their faces. So did I. We were just there going, there he is. He was waiting. He was waiting in turn for that one moment.
Well, we'll say the flip to that is, what did the drop kick lead to? Wasted returns, like what you maybe put over the Tanahashi's frog splash, since that was going to be such an important part in the match. The dropkick lead to, it was a setup move.
Yeah, that's what it's been turned into, because originally it was just a move he just did at the very beginning of the match, same like AJ Styles would do his, like, you know, thing with the ropes and then do his dropkick. Yeah, now in terms of the Rainmaker, his setup move is either a tombstone or a dropkick. Most of the time it's a dropkick to the back of the head. And then, because like you'll just like duck under, do the drop kick on the back of the head, and then pick him up and hit the Rainmaker. So it's developed from being just a showcase move to being one of the two signatures that sets up the main move now.
There is significance to it.
Yeah, there is significance.
That's cool. I'm thinking, because more thinking about the commentary, and I'd much prefer JR in the Nakamura match. I thought that the Nakamura story is much more natural story. This one, I thought he was great in spots, but I still thought he went to cliches, and I may have been Shoriker as in juxtaposition as well, but I got sick of them telling me how, oh, these are the best in the world.
Yeah,
tell me why. Don't just keep saying that over and over again.
I'll say that this was the point when Stryker was really starting to fucking piss me off, because as things got going and JR got better, Stryker with his over-talking, which we talked about, as we were afraid was going to happen anyway, and just saying so many things that added absolutely no value to the match or to the product at all, and is the kind of shit that Vince McMahon would say in your ear to say. Stuff like, isn't it great to be watching pro wrestling?
Even that line, that was like a cheap pop cliche to me.
Yeah, it was.
There's too much of that playing to the indie audience.
Yeah, exactly. Stop fucking jacking off and call the match. It's the main event of the show. Jim Ross is doing it. Don't fucking get in the way.
Well, that's the problem with Stryker. There are times where you will think, and I'm talking about his WWF run here as well, where you think, oh, okay, you know, over the course of a TV show or an event, you think, maybe I'm being a bit harsh here. The more you go through that show or that event and you get to the more important matches, he just can't help himself, because he feels he needs to emphasize so much, he just over talks and he goes on and on, and you were happy for those little moments where JR sort of reined him in. You made reference to the swerve remark, and he said, I've never been swerved in my life. He lied to the fans. Little things like that, just those little remarks where it's just sort of almost like a little hand on the shoulders to say, you know, settle down, prick features. I'm leading this dance.
I'm fucking this dog, just hold its head.
Yeah. I'm the lead, don't you forget it. Yeah. And you just, like, you referenced the arms stuff and his useless analogy for Strong Style, where he got trapped in his own metaphor, and it was just, we've been kind enough over the course of this podcast to Matt Stryker to not just descend into chaos, so I don't want to go down that route now, but suffice to say, when people use the old phrase, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? If Matt Stryker's there, you know it's made a sound, because he's going to hammer the fucking point home.
Yeah, I personally had a problem with the finish of the match with Okada not winning.
Yeah, let's talk about this.
That's me.
Is there anything you want to say?
There is nothing I want to say of particular significance here. I would just like to point out, for any listeners to the podcast who didn't have the pleasure of watching this show with us, that G was so upset with the result of this match, he instantly cried out, it's just like Austin and Rock, where the wrong guy goes over.
Yeah.
Because it fucking is.
For history's sake, you might have to repeat that, Carl, I think.
Yeah. Just for anyone who didn't quite hear that over the laughter, G came out with the remark, it's just like Austin and Rock, with the wrong guy going over.
I understand why they put Stone Cold over the same way as I understand why they put Tanahashi over. Doesn't mean I have to fucking like it. Okay, as a fan, I'm entitled to like someone else, okay? I'm sure maybe down the line, because we're going to get like another 50 of these matches between these two, yeah. I'm sure down the line, because the Japanese like to build it slowly, Okada will eventually get that win, and it'll mean a whole lot more as I pretty much explode all over the place. But in terms of like Okada and criticisms of him, they're absolutely fair enough. This is how I reason out, right, how Okada behaves early on in the match, right? This is how I kind of believe it, because I have noticed this myself, how he just looks so blank. That he is so cocky and so certain that he's the best and he's going to win, that it seems like everything is beneath him in the match. Okay, this is how I'm reasoning this, right? So, like, from the moment the bell rings, he's like, I'm winning this. And not just like self-confidence, he just knows, like there's some divine intervention that he knows he's going to win no matter what. So up until then, he's going through the motions of just like, okay, so he kicked out of that then, that's okay, I'm all building up to the Rainmaker anyway. It just seems like that kind of like weird thing of like, he doesn't seem to like care too much because everything's in hand. And it's only like to the point where by the end of the match, where, like, you know, they start turning the screws a little bit, and he's, you know, the babyface, whoever, starts kicking out of, you know, his key moves, like a tombstone or his drop kick or a rainmaker, something like that, that he starts getting affected because he's like, oh, well, hold on a sec, you're not supposed to be fucking doing that, are you? Because that's the only way I can reason it out. Otherwise, he's just really bad at selling, and he's my favourite, so I'm not going to say that. So I'm going to rationale it that basically he's just selling the fact that everyone's beneath him, and that he's certain he's going to win up until the very end, where they start turning the screws and he starts worrying that maybe he's going to doubt himself. The emotion comes out, like when he cries at the end. He goes, oh, I lost, that's not fair.
Okay, are either of the O'Rourke brothers sold by that explanation? Because I'm not.
I was just wondering if that was something Matt Stryker said on the show.
I'm not sold by that. I don't think that that's... I think he is so expressive near the end of the match. I think, honestly, it might be a sense in his own head of building the emotion. Look, I think it's more likely to be that than anything else. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you should be on cruise control.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's, you know, and the fact that they escalate and build, and by the end, it's always a great match. But yeah, no, even if you're building, you shouldn't have zero. You shouldn't be in a coma for the first half of the match.
No, it is a dereliction of duty. As a professional wrestler, see, I come out with phrases like this when I'm sober, folks. It is a dereliction of duty as a professional wrestler to have such mannerisms, regardless of whether or not your intention is to build up to a crescendo. If you're going to do that, that's absolutely fine. Not got a problem. But there is a difference between building up to a crescendo and appearing to have the face of a mannequin for 10 minutes.
Okay, I think that's fair enough. Anything you want to say to that in response, or if the hammer needs to go down as a final verdict, or
you'd put Okada a notch below Tanahashi, and you'd also put him a notch down over Nakamura. And you know what? Even though I don't personally agree with that, because Okada's my favourite, he's number one on my Fave Five. I absolutely agree with that. And this is going to be a big cop out, but. The reason why those two guys are a notch above Okada is experience level. Quite frankly, they've been doing this a lot longer than Okada, so obviously they've developed that ability where they can tell stories so well with minimal movements. All I'm going to say is, if Okada is still doing this in 10 years' time, then I certainly don't have a leg to stand on like I do now. But like, I'd say give him time and see if he does develop that game later on.
Ross loved Okada and was putting him over as a prodigy huge, which I think really helped the match. Yeah. And Tanahashi too, he actually, you know, really made him feel like he was the star and was the ace that the company in the match in general was trying to portray. I think, personal opinion, although you made a switch, I actually thought this was Ross's best performance in this match, because I really think at the very end when it was, because we're all, you know, you can hear the crowd live obviously, and all of us too, well, I shouldn't say all of us, but me, I know what I'm thinking, I don't know what everyone else is thinking exactly, but I was I didn't know which way it was going to go, and it was ebb and flow, and there were things that did hook me as kick outs and stuff like that. So and Ross was great on all of them, even busting out a few good God Almighties, which was fantastic. And at the end, it's like, the call was great. I love the fact that Okada sold it with tears. It did fucking mean something, and I think this is actually a bit of an extended thing, because on the New Year's Dash show the next day, he lost. If you know this, G, so I'll get your reaction. He came out very depressed, and lost clean to Bad Luck Farley.
So because I asked this on the night, what was the story behind the crying? Was he just...
No, they're pushing it, I guess. He's devastated by the loss. He's going to fall a little bit low before he builds himself back up.
So he's
finally,
depressed. I'm guessing... Like a bitchy cry. I wasn't sure.
No.
It was a very emotional cry.
Very emotional cry. But it was a crestfallen at the defeat. And they're going to do this kind of thing where he needs to get back on the saddle and it'll...
That kind of makes sense. Not losing to fucking fat fuck. that can piss off. What's wrong with Nagata? For Christ's sake, Jesus.
Well, Nagata, I didn't mention this before, Nagata did challenge Nakamura for the IC title, so that's happening on the next show.
Ooh! Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah, in terms of, like, him selling that, that's kind of, maybe kind of hones into the whole, like, the bullshit I was trying to sell. With you know, the cocky guy, just like, you know, thinking that he's...
We enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, I don't know, well, that's what I'm here for. Doesn't think his own shit smells, you know, and then at the end, when someone actually kind of proves him wrong, it hurts him. But in this time, because it's the second time it's happened on Wrestle Kingdom, he's now just broken. He's just broken of it, because it's that ego that's been, like, shattered now. So... that after we had our conversation on Sunday night after the show about it, I kind of thought more, which is why now I'm not so against Tanahashi winning, is because, okay, Tanahashi can go off and face AJ Styles, that's fine, they're going to do what they do with that. Well, so Okada now has an actually quite an interesting storyline of if he's doubting his own abilities, and it's like Okada trying to recover that magic he had, that kind of dominance that he showed in 2012 and 2013.
Oh, yeah. So that was the main event, and I thought it was a very good match. I thought that if you preferred that over Nakamura and Ibushi, I don't agree, but I could understand, because they're two different styles of match. I thought they were both really, really good, top notch stuff from Jim Ross too. Got some final thoughts on the commentary here from people before we move ahead. Colin Bollock started out quite clunky, with JR struggling a bit with a fast-paced opener. However, he started getting much better during the Suzuki-Sakuraba match, and it continued where he did a really good job with the final three. Striker was generally good, although I'm never a fan of him using insider terms. It sort of takes me out of the action a bit. Undefeated stakes, as JR wasn't a fan of the opening bouts, but once the show kicked in and the matches got better, so did he. As I said in another thread, Striker didn't fare well. He's fine in small doses and on Lucha Underground, but he sounded like a teenage fan straight from 2004, screaming for lariatos and saying that strong style proves wrestling isn't fake, not cool. I thought JR was everything he needed to be, and he gave it the big time feel. If GFW do Triple Mania, then I like Ross to team with Vampiro, or even better, Ross, Vampiro, and Don West. And by the way, we were the ones that got the Triple Mania scoop. Ian Drew Dice Clay, like the commentary, thought Jim Ross started off a bit lost and Striker started with his usual over-the-top willing to please himself, with odd references to PWG and other federations and silly jokes that only listeners of MLW's Talking Shop podcast would understand. But both got really relaxed and enjoyed themselves. I think Striker toned down his usual madness later on. I disagree. But he didn't want the bollocking of JR like when he said swerve. Ross, you got a sense, only came for the last three matches. He seemed to understand those were the three he'd be judged on, and nobody was going to talk about him calling the Young Bucks superkicks or Jarrett's guitar shot after the show was over. In fairness to JR, he also seemed to have done his homework on the Suzuki match, but it was by far the best Jim Ross commentary showing since about 2006. I don't know about anybody else, but I've always been underwhelmed by JR's commentary for years now. I said this in a previous thread, but maybe he's calling a product he enjoys for the first time in years. Innovative from TBWW on the commentary says, watch it the first time in Japanese from New Japan World, then rewatched some matches in English for JR and Striker's take, and I loved their call of the Makabe Ishii match. Smelly Meatball from TBWW said, saw it in English and felt the Striker-JR pairing was good overall. Liked how JR started to get more comfortable as the show went on, which really helped the later matches, a real theme here. And finally, Matt Yaxley says, commentary was a love-hate situation for me. I thought Jim Ross was everything I hoped for, particularly as the night went on, and he found his rhythm for a style of product he's not used to calling. Striker, on the other hand, was everything I was afraid of. Talked too much, and the guy just sounds like he's there to do nothing but jack off wrestling. Oh, actually, finally, one more. Linus, I really enjoyed the commentary and couldn't imagine watching a 4-hour show without it. Jim Ross lapsed into a weird parody of himself at times, and Matt Striker got a little overexcited, but together they did make a good team. Less authoritative play-by-play announce team, more like good pals who knew a good bit more than I did.
They didn't come across as pals.
Yeah. We did ride Striker pretty hard there, but I do think he did. He added a value to the show at times, and I think he detracted at the show at others. I thought Jim Ross did add to the show, even if that's a split opinion around the table.
He's still better than anyone else, but when he's eulogised over how great this guy is, I think you judge him on what he produces, and although he's still better than everyone else at 50%, he wasn't 100% Jim Ross. He wasn't familiar with the product. At times I thought he slipped into cliches for the storytelling, but that's just my honest opinion.
JR, I thought was really good. I mean, as I said earlier, I didn't think we were going to get 98 JR because he's a lot older now. But I was happy with his performance. I understood why, like, maybe he was more concentrated on the last three matches because, you know, in terms of his own personal emotions, he was building the show up in terms of commentary as well. You know, he can't call everything as being amazing because then none of it is. So of course he was going to really go out on a limb on the last three matches. In terms of Striker, I wasn't as offended as everyone else in the room was. In fairness, how I see it with Striker is, I would, this is a thing to say, I would take Striker's commentary over what I listen to every Monday night on Raw. And me and Liam,
because we don't listen to it.
Yeah, I know, because I did watch it. This sounds such a weird compliment to give, but at least he talks. If you kind of go what I mean, because like with Monday Night Raw this time, or even on like WrestleManias, where they just, there's just pauses, long gaps.
Rock versus Cena and time stands still on commentary.
They're not fucking talking, or if they do, they're taking jokes, or they're talking about fucking Total Divas during an IC title match. They just keep making mistakes. At least Striker, yes, he's a bell end, but he's a but he's a bell end that's trying. Okay, he's trying not to be a bell end.
He's very trying.
He's trying to do his best, and when kind of judging this commentary, how I'm going to judge how these two worked was, how did they benefit anybody who was new to the Japanese product? Okay, and I mean, they had no idea. I mean, Carl was new to the product, but he's familiar with Japanese wrestling. So let's just assume that there were people watching the show that know nothing about Japanese at all. did they together do a good job of at least either like telling the stories of the key matches, putting over stats and figures that, you know, that were important that they didn't realise, you know, obviously that the average person would not know because they haven't been following the product. And did they have enough emotion? And I think like JR did, and I think Stryker was satisfactory enough that he put over the facts that anyone knew watching his product would go, okay, he wasn't fantastic, but he gave me enough information that I understood what I was watching. Because at the end of the day, that was the point of bringing in Stryker and Jim Ross, was to help the foreigners understand.
I think if Matt Stryker does that exact same performance on a WWE show, you shit down his throat.
Yeah. He's crucified for it.
The thing is, and I think the emailers, as a rule of thumb, they gave the sort of commentary a very, very accurate overview. JR got better as the night went on, and when there was more focus on individuals in matches, when you get away from the multiple tags and that sort of thing. And I understand completely what Kieran is saying in terms of, we're only critical of Jim Ross in the sense of it's Jim Ross and the bar is so high with him. Any criticism is not necessarily to say that Jim Ross was poor, because he wasn't. When he needed to be good, he was really good. And there were sort of tidbits of information that he threw in which helped really add relevance to things. Matt Stryker, Look, he's enthusiastic, I get it, and I'm not one to fault people for their enthusiasm. You asked if he gave anybody new, who hadn't seen the product before, did he help them? I don't think Matt Stryker did anything to help anyone who wouldn't have seen that wrestling before.
Did he help you?
No, of course he didn't. He was over the top. A lot of his commentary came across as right, giving a, it was a love letter to the independents, and he just couldn't help himself by talking over JR at certain moments. JR would make a point and he would jump in to add to it when it didn't need to be added to, and it's just the way it came across to me. JR was there to call a wrestling show. Matt Stryker was there almost coming across as if he's trying to do audition for another job.
Yeah, that's a fair point. We've got a couple more pieces of feedback here that I want to get to before we wrap it up. Undefeated Steak also chimed in with, in his general opinion on the show, excellent, I really got my enthusiasm back for wrestling recently, and events like this make you glad that you stick to the shite. One of Raw's biggest problems is that the entire show is so flat. There's nothing to look forward to during the show, and the opening matches are indistinguishable from the main events. Wrestle Kingdom 9 was the complete opposite. The show and anticipation built throughout the night to culminate in their best match on the card, the main event. They also offered enough of a variety that if one match wasn't your cup of tea, then the next was something entirely different. New Japan have a new fan here.
It was a very good presentation, and I will watch some stuff in future. I lent not the most recent G1 Climax from yourself, but the one the year before, not too long ago, and really enjoyed that. So whenever I watch it, it's enjoyable.
I've probably come across really negative on the show. I didn't think there was a bad match on the show. I really enjoy the show overall. Maybe I'm talking from a reaction point of view because A, hyperbolic other people have gotten about it, and I'm reacting to that. It was just a really good show. I think in terms of connecting, on the Jarrett interview, he talked about connecting, and we talked about it at length as well. My opinion on that hasn't changed. New Japan in-ring is better than anything else out there, obviously, and Japanese wrestling has rebounded from probably its darkest period on the back of Tanahashi. And my honest feeling is because of that, people maybe blow it out of proportion more than it deserves to be. I compare it to Kobashi, Misawa stuff from All Japan, and it's nowhere near for me. But then, yeah, compared to in-ring compared to other stuff today, yeah, absolutely, it's great. It's not significant enough for me. It's, again, maybe it's the really 50-50 on it, because I probably sound really negative, and I really don't mean to be. But in terms of changing the landscape, nothing's changed. It'll still appeal. It's people within wrestling will find it a greatly entertaining product. But I don't think it's going to change the world. It's not going to change anything.
For me, obviously, being a fan, I absolutely love the show. I thought it was the best Wrestle Kingdom that they've done. I thought he was the most consistent. But, you know, once you got to Ishii, who finally got his match at Wrestle Kingdom, because he never got one before, you know, I think Omega, Goto and Shibata winning the belts was the right move. And, you know, AJ and Naito was entertaining. We got two great matches, two Match of the Year candidates in the final of that show, which we will be still be mentioning by the end of the year, I firmly believe. Yeah, I think the product's great. I will continue watching it. I will be watching the next pay-per-view or whatever show, however, whichever means we get it, next month. And yeah, long may they continue. And in terms of GFW, yeah, hopefully if the figures do come in high, because I think Jarrah mentioned about doing like G1.
Yeah, yeah.
So if the figures are high, then that's going to be surely a certainty.
All right, so on that note then, thank you very much for listening. If there was any additional feedback that we didn't get to, I apologise. We have, in fact, run out of time. So I want to thank everybody for listening. For Kieran O'Rourke.
Thank you very much.
For Carl Jones.
He called me a sheep earlier. It's the most offensive thing I've ever been called on a wrestling podcast.
And for G. John Chase.
Yow!
I am Liam O'Rourke. Wait a minute, Kieran. Brian Clark's not fucking dead.